a snake on my back. I keep a red bone on my side.
Good morning. Good morning and welcome to Rogue Warrior Radio. You're tuned in live this Tuesday, December 29th, 2020 on the one and only Republic Broadcasting Network. And as always, thanks for coming along for the ride. It is a wild and dystopic ride. It's interesting. Could we ever break through the cognitive dissonance? In the Bible, James, for example, wrote about how a double-minded man is unstable in all his ways and ought to expect nothing. We've been engineered to think that way. I mean, if we could call it thinking, to behave that way, certainly. And, you know, again, just as a reminder, Neil Postman talked about this, and the word, the operative word and the operative concept was discontinuity. And it's really interesting when you sit down and you sort of think about how that works. Maybe listen to Postman a little bit in some of his interviews. C-SPAN is a good place to look for those. You can find some on YouTube. But, you know, if we could break through that, maybe we could break through, crash through in Von Ryan's Express sort of fashion, through the cognitive dissonance, through the cultural Marxism, and, you know, this idea that we're supposed to basically, America's supposed to commit suicide. I mean, you remember, for example, Theodore Adorno, the article I need to get back to, Jeffrey Steinberg's article in Lyndon LaRouche's Executive Intelligence Review back in May of 2000, From Cybernetics to Littleton, Techniques of Mind Control. You know, I wonder if this isn't maybe in view in Nashville these days, but we don't have a Manchurian Patsy on our hands. But Steinberg reminded us from the article, he said, you know, the authors of The Authoritarian Personality. Remember that? Maybe we'll dive into this a little bit today, maybe not. The authors of The Authoritarian Personality let it all hang out in the concluding chapter of the book, in which they summarized their findings and spelled out their recipe for social transformation. And this is something that most people don't realize has been at work since World War II. It's continued. The denazification of the world, so-called. But actually, you know, so it's like everything else, you know, we'll create a problem and then we have a solution for that that's actually a problem or brings in tow with it many more problems, creates more problems. But you know what? We can solve those. But wait, those spawn more problems, but we have solutions for those that spawn more problems. You kind of get a pattern here that we've seen develop over the course of particularly of the 20th century. And you know, the same kind of like with the virus and the vaccine, the same people that brought you the problem are the same people advocating for the so-called solution. And just as a parenthetical aside on that, as Catherine Austin Fitz observed, it's interesting that the people who want all of the contact tracing and stuff, those that are pushing for it hardest are also the folks who flew on Epstein Air. How convenient. Why would they want to track everyone else, especially children? I don't know. So anyway, speaking of the perverse of mind, the authors of The Authoritarian Personality let it all hang out in the concluding chapter of the book, in which they summarized their findings and spelled out their recipe for social transformation. Quote, it seems obvious that the modification of the potentially fascist structure cannot be achieved by psychological means alone. The task is comparable to that of eliminating neurosis or delinquency or nationalism from the world. These are products of the total organization of society and are to be changed only as that society is changed. It is not for the psychologist to say how such changes are to be brought about. The problem is one which requires the efforts of all social scientists. All that we would insist upon is that in the councils or roundtables where the problem is considered and action planned, the psychologist should have a voice. Is that a Delphi voice or... I digress. We believe that the scientific understanding of society must include an understanding of what it does to people and that it is possible to have social reforms, even broad and sweeping ones, which, though desirable in their own right, would not necessarily change the structure of the prejudiced personality. The prejudiced personality. When I watch children play, I don't know, for some reason I don't see this prejudiced personality. Again, I digress. For the fascist potential to change or even to be held in check, there must be an increase in people's capacity to see themselves and to be themselves. What does that mean, guys? This cannot be achieved by the manipulation of people, however well grounded in modern psychology the devices of manipulation might be. It is here that psychology may play its most important role. Techniques for overcoming resistance, developed mainly in the field of individual psychotherapy, can be improved and adapted for use with groups and even for use on a mass scale. The authors conclude with the most revealing proposition, quote, we need not suppose that appeal to emotion belongs to those who strive in the direction of fascism, while democratic propaganda must limit itself to reason and restraint. If fear and destructiveness are the major emotional sources of fascism, Eros belongs mainly to democracy. Ah, yes, Eros, the tool of the Bernaysian contingent. So Eros, Steinberg writes, was precisely the weapon that the Frankfurt School and their fellow travelers employed over the next 50 years to create a cultural paradigm shift away from the so-called authoritarian, quote-unquote, matrix of man in the living image of God, imago viva Dei. The sanctity of the nuclear family and the superiority of the republican form of nation-state over all other forms of political organization. They transformed American culture toward an erotic, perverse matrix associated with the present politically correct, quote-unquote, tyranny of tolerance for dehumanizing drug abuse, sexual perversion, and the glorification of violence. For the Marxist Freudian revolutionaries of the Frankfurt School, the ultimate antidote to the hated Western Judeo-Christian civilization was to tear that civilization down from the inside by turning out generations of necrophiliacs. And as I have said, the way that I sort of restate this is, you know, you listen to the Adornos, the Horkheimers, the Marcuses, and they say that the salvation and liberation of man can only be accomplished by plunging him into utter depravity, which is absolutely absurd, of course, but this is what they set out to do. So Steinberg continues, if this statement, well, again, he says, you know, their plan was, you know, the antidote, the Western civilization, was to turn out generations of necrophiliacs, tearing this civilization down from the inside by doing just that. So he says, if this statement seems harsh, consider the following. In his 1948 work on the philosophy of modern music, and consider this, 1948, this is before everything, before rock and roll, before the King, before, you know, this is back in, gosh, the heyday of, you know, the big band era and the I don't know, the Glenn Miller days and I don't know, the A-Train, Pennsylvania 65,000, these kinds of things. Much more unassuming times than, say, AC/DC, Back in Black, that kind of stuff, which is more overtly this kind of thing. But in 1948, in his work on the philosophy of modern music, Frankfurt School leader Theodor Adorno argued that the purpose of modern music is to literally drive the listener insane. This was 1948. The purpose of modern music is to literally drive the listener insane. He justified this by asserting that modern society was a hotbed of evil authoritarianism and potential fascism, and that only by first destroying civilization through the spread of all forms of cultural pessimism and perversity could liberation occur. On the role of modern music, he wrote, quote, it is not that schizophrenia is directly expressed therein, but the music, and so what do we call it these days? Cognitive dissonance, because that's sexy, but schizophrenia, not so cool. It is not that schizophrenia is directly expressed therein, but the music imprints upon itself an attitude similar to that of the mentally ill. The individual brings about his own disintegration. He imagines the fulfillment of the promise through magic, but nonetheless within the realm of immediate actuality. Its concern is to dominate schizophrenic traits through the aesthetic consciousness. In so doing, it would hope to vindicate insanity as true health. Necrophilia, he added, is the ultimate expression of true health in this sick society. That's what Theodore Adorno wrote, cultural Marxist Frankfurt School leader. And so this is, you know, the mind virus that has been circulated throughout Western society, America in particular, ever since the Frankfurt School cultural Marxist contingent was able to, well, not able, but enlisted, I guess, to do just this sort of thing. And just as a final note, it's also interesting to note, as some have observed, Herbert Marcuse, let's see, Wikipedia entry. Between 1943 and 1950, Marcuse worked in the U.S. government. This is Wikipedia, for Pete's sake. So, I mean, if Wikipedia has this, then how much more interesting is the whole truth, if you will? Actually, let me back up. Might as well. Herbert Marcuse was a German-American philosopher, sociologist, beware the sociologist, and political theorist associated with the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. Born in Berlin, Marcuse studied at the Humboldt University of Berlin and then at Freiburg, where he received his PhD. He was a prominent figure in the Frankfurt-based Institute for Social Research, what later became known as the Frankfurt School. He was married to Sophie Wertheim, Inga Neumann, and Erika Schirover. In his written works, he criticized capitalism, modern technology, Soviet communism, and entertainment culture, arguing that they represent new forms of social control. But next paragraph. Between 1943 and 1950, Marcuse worked in the U.S. government, worked in the U.S. government service for the Office of Strategic Services, predecessor of the CIA, where he criticized the ideology of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union in the book Soviet Marxism, A Critical Analysis, 1958. In the 60s and 70s, he became known as the preeminent theorist of the New Left and the student movements of West Germany, France, and the United States. Some consider him the father of the New Left. I would say we could consider him the father of contemporary color revolution. And, you know, from there you have guys like Alinsky carrying the torch and so on. His best known works are Eros and Civilization, 1955, and One Dimensional Man, 1964. His Marxist scholarship inspired many radical intellectuals and political activists in the 60s and 70s, both in the United States and internationally. One Dimensional Man is interesting. We've talked about that. Most notably, usually when Larkin, Texas calls. Stick around, we'll be right back.
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now, but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing. knowledge, and knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Welcome back. In War is a Racket, Major General Smedley Darlington Butler wrote, still one of the most highly decorated military men in American military service history. Seems like an odd segue, but maybe not. I suppose I'll explain a little bit. So yesterday, Pat, during your call, you know, you mentioned suicides. I think I mentioned Dr. Martin Seligman, who is the guy who pioneered, he and a colleague pioneered the learned helplessness theory at University of Pennsylvania. By, you know, as the story went early on, randomly and repeatedly shocking dogs, just, you know, they happened upon this thing called learned helplessness theory, which was total BS. It was born, or, you know, their research built upon mountains of research that had gone before them, and researchers, sociologists in particular, you know, cyberneticians and folks like John B. Watson and the Little Albert experiment. Give me anyone and I can. So, you know, Martin Seligman is an interesting guy that I've talked about. Jane Mayer. You know, when you start to look into the war on terror and the really hardcore stuff that was sort of green-lighted under the specious guise of SEER training. You know, we're going to train these guys not to confess state secrets if they get tortured. Really what we're doing is we're training them how to torture people. And so, you know, as I've said before, when you see the pictures, for example, of the, you know, the figure, the hooded figure with outstretched arms and the little probes on the fingers standing on a milk crate, that's basically Dr. Martin Seligman's work. And so Jane Mayer wrote about this, among others, The Dark Side was her book, The Inside Story of How the War on Terror Turned into a War on American Ideals. But this really is not a new subject. Again, if we go back to the – if we're honest with ourselves, then, you know, maybe we – you know, go back to War Against the Weak, Iowa in Black, or maybe we go back to War is a Racket by Smedley Butler. I'm sensing a theme here. War is. So in her book, The Dark Side, The Inside Story of How the War on Terror Turned into a War on American Ideals, Jane Mayer talked about Martin Seligman's work, you know, basically him being brought in through Mitchell Jessen, which was a CIA front, to ostensibly teach special forces how to resist torture, actually, you know, teaching them how to torture and, you know, green lighting this kind of stuff. Well, Martin Seligman, and, you know, then there was the whole extraordinary rendition discussion. Is it really torture? Yeah, we don't need to argue about it. It's torture. But this is not a new subject. Again, War Against the Weak, War is a Racket. Many other books have been written on this subject. And so we have been convinced over and over again that, you know, maybe we should do these things because there's some surreptitious justification. Well, Specialist Michael Anthony wrote the book back in, 2007, 2008? And I had him on the broadcast when his book was published to talk about his book. I think it was 2008. Let's see. Let's look, shall we? 2009, really? Mass Casualties, A Young Medic's True Story of Death, Deception, and Dishonor in Iraq. So we talked about this, and speaking of Martin Seligman, you know, so Michael Anthony detailed why we have a suicide epidemic in the military. It's this kind of stuff that he wrote about, and I intended to touch on that a little bit later. But Dr. Martin Seligman was the guy who was brought in. Hey, you know, we have the suicide epidemic in the services. People realize they're doing horrible things. What can we do? Well, you know, let's use learned helplessness theory and flip it so that we can make them feel good about these awful things that they're doing. That's basically what Martin Seligman was brought in to do. So if we only knew, if we could break through all this cognitive dissonance, man, America and the world could be a great place. Stick around. I'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Is your property a financial burden and causing you grief? Have you tried to sell but can't find buyers? Or are you just too busy to sell your property? Don't worry. We have the right solution for you. We buy properties as is, with cash, close in 30 days, and pay all closing costs. Our service is ideal for property owners who are in pre-foreclosure, have high-end repair costs, experiencing financial hardship, going through costly divorces, are relocating, need cash for retirement, suffering family loss, or have tax liens. Whatever your situation may be, We can help you sell your property and get the money you need. If you own a single-family home or multiple family units, call us for a free consultation at 888-910-1037. That's 888-910-1037. Or visit our website at cashingproperty.com. That's cashingproperty.com. Sell your property fast and leave all your worries behind.
Extendivite has proven time and again it really works. Here's a testimonial from Amazon.com. I am only 40, but I have put my body through hell working in manufacturing for 20 years. I recently started to notice a buzzing feeling along with a stuttering sensation with my heart. I had a full cardio stress done, which I passed. I decided to try Extendivite after getting the jingle stuck in my head. Halfway through the bottle, I really did notice a difference. After getting home from work, I would just sit in a chair for a few hours feeling like crap, and this stuff reduced that feeling along with heart discomfort to almost nothing. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a two-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from simplycleanfoods.net, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters. Right now, Amazon Prime members will receive fast two-day shipping. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's simplycleanfoods.net. But do it today.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on a tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean.
Welcome back. Bottom of the first hour of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast. It's Tuesday, December 29th, 2020. You know what? Let's do another awkward segue. Not really. I'm going to tie it all together. I'm going to come back to specialist Michael Anthony's 2009 book, Mass Casualties, which I've talked about before, but I mean, that really describes the story. Before I do that, though, let's tie the cultural Marxist thing back together with the ideological subversion that Yuri Bezmenov talked about. And there was more to that story. And so What is the more? The more is brought to us by Mr. Academic Agent, along with sources. You can click on the description of the video titled Demoralization, What Yuri Bezmenov Didn't Tell You. This was published in October of this year. And so, to fit it all in without further ado, give this a listen. Go ahead, please.
I'm sure most people watching this are aware of the former KGB agent turned CIA informant Yuri Bezmenov. In the 1980s, Bezmenov went around the USA speaking mostly to conservative groups about how the USA had been infiltrated with communist agents sent from Moscow. When many people started to pay attention to what was going on in politics on YouTube a few years back, many of his interviews and lectures went viral. And for a lot of people, this was one of their first steps to having their eyes opened. He describes a four-stage process of demoralization, destabilization, crisis, and normalization, a deliberate Soviet attempt at infiltration and subversion. Now, many aspects of this story are true, but I'm afraid that there are some details old Yuri left out. And besides, you've got to ask yourself, how is it that you've heard of this guy? How is it that millions of people have watched Yuri Bezmenov videos here on YouTube? Why is it, as I pointed out a couple of months ago, that Yuri has been mainstreamed? Well, I'm going to answer some of those questions shortly, but first, let's take a quick break.
If you like Academic Agent's content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
Okay, so what's wrong with the story Yuri Bezmenov tells? I will explain. But before I do so, let me note that in this video I'm going to be using very mainstream sources, by which I mean left-wing journals and Wikipedia entries, in order to show that there is no aspect of what I'm telling you that could be described as conspiracy theory. This is all completely open information, freely available to anyone with access to Google. Okay, with that noted, the problem with Yuri's narrative is that the ultimate source of the demoralization program he describes was not Moscow, but Frankfurt, and specifically the Frankfurt School, which I am sure you have heard of. It included a group of radical thinkers, including Theodor Adorno, Max Horkheimer, Erich Fromm, and Herbert Marcuse. The Institute for Social Research at Goethe University in Frankfurt was set up in 1923 by the Marxist Karl Grunberg. It was bankrolled by the son of a German millionaire grain merchant. Importantly, though, this was an alternative branch of Marxism which was against the Soviet project and sought to analyze its problems, which is to say that it was entirely independent of Moscow. Max Horkheimer took over as director of the Institute in 1930 and then recruited Adorno, Fromm, and later Marcuse, among others. After the rise of Hitler in 1933, Horkheimer moved the Institute from Frankfurt to Geneva. Erich Fromm went on a trip to the United States around this time, where he persuaded Columbia University, based in New York, to grant the Institute for Social Research refuge while Germany was under Nazi rule. And so the Frankfurt School new home from 1935 was New York City. While there, the Frankfurt School devoted much thought to what had gone wrong in Germany, from their perspective, and located the problem in both the German mindset, which is to say the psychology of the German people, and in German culture, which is to say the cultural modes which perpetuate this psychology. Antisemitism, for example, was diagnosed as a pathology, a symptom of the authoritarian personality type. Horkheimer made a number of strategic alliances in New York. Most importantly, he allied the Frankfurt School with the American Jewish Committee, a non-profit Jewish advocacy group which is headquartered in New York, which had some, but not total, influence in Washington. The Frankfurt School proposed some very radical solutions to the problem of fascism in Europe. As early as 1941, Horkheimer had drawn up plans for nothing less than the total re-education of the German people, the aims of which were, quote, the mental transformation of the German human being, culture, and society towards democracy, morality, which respects human dignity, and the world. In 1942, Herbert Marcuse started working directly for the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor organization of the CIA. Now, I should be clear here, this is not to suggest that the Frankfurt School or Marcuse were directly in charge of running US government policy or anything like it. A country like the USA is big and complex. The government is not a monolith. It has different networks and different nodes of power. For example, for almost the entirety of his time working for the government, Marcuse was under surveillance by the FBI and a suspicion of being a communist infiltrator. And, in fact, this dynamic of these Frankfurt School thinkers operating in the US government at the same time that the Red Scare was going on is a source of much confusion. But all of this should be made much clearer in your own mind if you see the Frankfurt School thinkers as the new left, entirely independent of and even against Moscow and the Soviet Union, who are the old left. As Marcuse and others, such as Franz Neumann and Otto Kirchheimer, joined the Office of Strategic Services in Washington, D.C., Horkheimer and Adorno relocated to California. Horkheimer had been appointed as director of the scientific division of the American Jewish Committee, and it was in this capacity he started his Five Studies in Prejudice and the aforementioned research into the authoritarian personality type. When the Second World War ended, the Allied powers embarked on a program called denazification, a vast propaganda effort essentially to convert the German population from supporting Nazism to supporting liberal democracy, in the case of West Germany, and to supporting socialism or communism in the case of East Germany. The administration for this program was divided into four zones, one under the Americans, one under the British, one under the Soviets, and one under the French. This is significant because we can see side by side how the denazification effort, as directed by Washington and Moscow respectively, were applied. Note that Horkheimer's plan to completely re-educate and remold the German mindset from the ground up, or I should say from the top down, was here effectively adopted as the official policy of the US federal government. In order to achieve their aims, General Eisenhower set up the Institute on Re-education of the Axis countries, stating, "Only an inflexible long-term occupation authority will be able to lead the Germans to a fundamental revision of their recent political philosophy." This was under the auspices of the Psychological Warfare Division of the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. Now, if the phrase psychological warfare sounds familiar to you, perhaps it is because our old friend Yuri Bezmenov uses it to describe the four-stage process of demoralization and subversion. Now, in practice, the Americans faced two quite separate problems here. The first was the very practical problem that if they arrested anyone who would work for the Nazi Party or the German government in any capacity at all, it would result in having to process over 35 million people. The second was the more intangible issue of the everyday thoughts and beliefs of the German people. The logistical nightmare of the first problem led the US Army to declare that most German people had simply been brainwashed by Nazi propaganda. So efforts were intensified on the second problem. The US Army seized 37 German newspapers, 6 radio stations, 314 theaters, 642 cinemas, 101 magazines, 237 book publishers, and 7,384 book dealers and printers. Over 30,000 books were banned. All copies of these books were confiscated and destroyed. The representative of the military directorate admitted that the order was in principle no different from the Nazi book burnings. Remember, always accuse your enemy of that which you are guilty yourself. Now, although in the short term only high-ranking Nazis were individually punished and most Germans were not, under the logic that they had been brainwashed, In the longer term, the official policy of the American denazification program was to get Germans to accept collective responsibility for what had happened, including posters which showed atrocities and said things like, "This is your fault," and "These atrocities, your fault." And this is chiefly where the Frankfurt School's work on fascism being some sort of inborn psychological trait of the German mindset started to take root as official policy. In Fascism, the Career of a Concept, Paul Gottfried chronicles how the definition of fascism, or the authoritarian personality type, expanded far beyond the specific atrocities of the Nazis and came to be seen as something endemic in German culture and history as a whole, even going so far as to implicate Christianity itself. Sidney Bernstein, the chief of the Psychological Warfare Division in 1946, said, "The aim of this program was to shake and humiliate the Germans and prove to them, beyond any possible challenge, that these German crimes against humanity were committed and that the German people, and not just the Nazis and the SS, bore responsibility. In fact, America forced Germany through all four stages of the process that Yuri Bezmenov describes, and by the 1970s had been largely successful. Certainly, if you look at Germany today, you can see just how successful they were. I think it's notable that most of the support for the AfD, for example, which is the far-right group, or the so-called far-right group in Germany, is in East Germany, not in West Germany. In contrast, the Soviets, in their denazification efforts, did practically none of this. They were much more brutal and much less sophisticated in their methods, simply sending former Nazis to the Gulag, and their propaganda efforts were focused much more squarely on getting Germans to accept socialism and remove anti-socialist sentiment, rather than to renounce their entire history and culture and accept responsibility collectively for Nazi atrocities. You can see how different the approach was from the American effort just from these few details. Now, at the top level, successive American governments came to lose interest in the denazification program as they became more embroiled in the Cold War. In 1949, Horkheimer and Adorno returned to Frankfurt and re-established the Institute of Social Research. Around this time, the US formally handed over control of the process to the Germans, who would now be responsible for their own re-education. Now, it strikes me that since this time, since 1949, 1950, the institutions and processes that were set up in the direct aftermath of World War II continued largely unchecked. The definition of fascism didn't stop with the German people or with German culture. Over time, it expanded to include European culture as a whole, British culture, and indeed American culture. No one person needed to be in charge of this. It worked almost by itself. As Frankfurt School type thought came to dominate Western universities in the 1960s and onwards, not as the result of infiltration from Moscow, but as a form of continuation from systems, institutions, and programs that had been set up by the Frankfurt School and their allies in the 1940s. If the original sin of the Germans was to be the Holocaust, each other country would find its own original sin. In Britain, it was the empire and colonialism. In America, it was slavery and racism. Now, in 2020, all of these things have coalesced into one unifying concept called whiteness. And for the re-education program finally to be completed, of course, the symbols of these things must be destroyed, or else the new mindset cannot take root. In other words, the denazification program never ended. It only expanded itself to include more and more things under the definition of fascism. That's why Antifa see themselves as fighting fascism. So now you know what Yuri didn't tell you.
If you like academic... Isn't that something? Yeah. Things Yuri didn't tell us. And, you know, this also calls to mind, or at least for me, Norman Dodd's interview, 1982. And the comfortable merger with the Soviet Union that he intimated, you know, the conversation with Horace Rowan Gaither Jr., newly minted president of the Ford Foundation, who said, you know, would you like to know what we're up to? And Norman Dodd said, sure, that's why I'm here. And Gaither said, we operate, you know, most of us have a background in the OSS, like old Herbert Marcuse. And, you know, we operate on directives that issue from the White House, the substance of which is to create a comfortable merger with the Soviet Union. But we've all assumed it was the Soviet system. This sheds light, doesn't it? We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Dr. Leonard Horowitz. I was right 30 years ago in warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen plan to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful, loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile OxySilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Extendivite 7-herb formulation is approved to help maintain cardiovascular health and help lower blood lipid levels in adults. Extendivite is made from hawthorn, garlic, valerian, cayenne, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, and milk thistle. The herbs in Extendivite have been chosen for their ability to help with overall health. Many people have reported improved energy and stamina in just a few months. If you think you could feel just a little bit better, then Extendivite may just be for you. Extendivite is an all-natural supplement. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a two-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle humps, ready to race to you.
These days are ours.
Happy days.
These days are ours. Shepherd with me. These days are ours.
Welcome back. What would happen if we, you know, here's an interesting thought. I was just thinking, what would happen if we, took our own mental well-being or even our own physical well-being as seriously as we take other things, you know, tailgating parties and things like that. College and professional sports, people take that stuff very seriously. Their identity gets all wrapped up in it. Imagine if we took our own, you know, American civics, our own local government and so forth, that seriously. I've talked to several people lately who say, you know, yeah, I should be more involved. I should. Well, there are two sides to that, I think. You know, there is the Lucius Trust element that wants to bring you along in tow in storytelling fashion, where you're being led by the nose through this game theory matrix to have you, you know, it's a little too easy. It's not a legitimate organic experience, because that would be difficult. That would imply effort on our part. You know, that would be something that you couldn't script and you couldn't kind of herd people through and guide and direct. And it takes too much effort. And in this convenience driven, entirely domesticated society, we're not willing to exercise that much effort, because after all, we've been groomed for generations on this convenience thought. So it needs to be easier than that. So we kind of like the feel of the game theory maze, and being led by the nose is comfortable through your own. I want a little participation in Encyclopedia Brown sort of fashion, but I don't want to go out and have to actually dig up my own clues and things. I just want those fed to me, and then I'll choose my own adventure. But what if we took life and our own civics and so forth, if we broke out of that and took the, you know, reality as seriously as people take college and professional sports? I wonder. Remember Key and Peele did that sketch on, you know, if teachers were treated like professional athletes, how different that would be. And I just wonder, you know, I mentioned Michael Lewis's The Undoing Project yesterday, and there is just a brief hint of the actual implications of the research that he wrote about in The Undoing Project in the book, even though I would say the book itself is sort of an example of, you know, an experiment in practice of the research about which Lewis wrote. Anyway, more on that when we come back. Second hour coming up. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
You're listening to Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.